Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott.
So look at me.
The first thing I see when I walk into Virginia Kerr's apartment is a bonsai tree, growing in a bowl designed to look like a little landscape. Tiny ivy crawls on a pergola the size of my hand. And
it looks like a tiny elephant plant,
it
right?
It is a tiny elephant plant.
Oh, is it?
It is.
Oh, my goodness.
It is. This is a tiny grass.
All right, I love miniature, so I'm freaking out a little bit here. And I'm about to enter the workshop of my dreams.
Oh my goodness, I love it.
It was the houses I was looking, so I started designing my own houses.
Virginia is an architect by training, and she has shifted her career to build miniature houses, perfect to the very last detail.
It looks like a living room. There's a fireplace with a marble mantle and these beautiful built-in bookshelves and this gorgeous floor. What is this floor made of?
It was a sushi mat that I broke.
A sushi mat?
Yeah, to roll the sushis.
Uh-huh.
I broke the sushi mat and I get it with the stick, so I glue them together and I sand them.
Virginia builds on a 1 to 24 scale. That's what architects use when they make models. By comparison, that's half the size of dollhouses and dollhouse furniture.
Oh, but that was the craziest thing because I use...
When she makes bricks for her little houses, she cuts them from egg cartons with an X-Acto knife. She paints them, grouts them.
And then I paint it again.
Until they have the look of a weathered row house facade. She makes her own little hinges for doors and windows.
Oh my goodness, so you can open the windows?
Oh, above. Yeah, yes.
The work is equal measures demanding, repetitive, intensely creative. Every object, every scrap of trash can become something new.
You get in a zone and forget about everything.
Virginia says this work is more satisfying than being an architect because it's her project, start to finish.
Yeah, that's my problem. I'm extremely perfectionist. Let me show you this one here.
And there's something else. It allows her to make her own world from scratch to her liking. For example, she's an artist and she always dreamed of showing her paintings in a gallery.
So I thought, why don't I make my own gallery and have my own exhibition? So that's what I make this building.
She points to the tiny gallery she's built. It has floor-to-ceiling windows, shiny hardwood floors. On the walls, a miniature version of one of her paintings.
That painting is that painting.
The regular size one hangs in her living room, the mini replica in Virginia's beautiful gallery, illuminated by track lighting the size of Tic Tacs. Everything is still. Everything is as she wants it to be.
You have control. And it is good now having some control. I decide what goes where, what to do, what not to do, how color is going to go.
It sounds appealing, right? To be the creator of your own perfect world. And I think this idea of control over what happens is crucial in terms of why people do this. Humans have long walked around in this world while dreaming of making their own, where everything is better, simpler, more interesting. But it doesn't always work out. On this episode, we explore man-made worlds, why we create them, and what happens when things go wrong. Our first story is about people trying to create a parcel of rugged wilderness in a densely populated country, the Netherlands. They called it the Oswaldersplassen. Sometimes it's referred to as the Dutch Serengeti. But soon, this landscape that was set aside and fenced in for nature and animals to flourish became a battleground for humans. Stefan has the story about a conservation effort gone haywire.
It was a scene out of a nightmare. The smell of death permeated the air.
I cannot even describe it. I even smell it now.
Karen Soelting was walking down the paths of the Oswaldersplassen for the first time 2 winters ago.
How you say it? Cemetery, that's the word. It was like a cemetery. without burying, but there were dead animals everywhere.
Heaps of bones, carcasses, scattered over a desolate moon-like landscape. Karen is an animal welfare activist, and she had been hearing rumors that all wasn't right at the Ausfeders Plaza. But this was far worse than she expected.
When you walked every 2-3 meters, you had another dead animal, sometimes a few together. It was like a war zone. We never imagined something like this could happen in Holland.
The thing is, this place, this nature reserve, it was supposed to be a paradise. Today, it's not hard to get to the Ausfeders Plaza. It's an hour by train from Amsterdam, and the reserve is easily seen from a highway and train line that run right by it. But if you visited the site 60 years ago, the entire thing would have been underwater. In the 50s and 60s, the Netherlands initiated a massive drainage project, installing dikes and pump stations. From what used to be seafloor, rose an entirely new Dutch province, called Flevoland. The government rained seeds down on the newborn land from airplanes. From those seeds, fresh reed beds started to grow. Originally, the area was slated for industry and agriculture. The soil was unusually fertile. But pretty quickly...
Yeah, the explosion and the new burst of life.
That's Menno Bart van Eerden, an ecologist who's been studying the Ausfeders Plaza since its earliest days. He says biologists and nature lovers soon noticed a rich wetland ecosystem emerging. They pushed for almost 6,000 hectares, an area about the size of Manhattan, to be set aside as a nature reserve. And they succeeded. It was a huge win for conservation.
You see, it never happens that area that is so rich in potential production is then turned into a nature area.
For a while, it was heaven on earth.
For plants and for animals, for everything. This is something I've never seen before.
Herons, egrets, spoonbills, and other rare birds were turning up and breeding. But because the soil was so fertile...
The trees were growing faster than everywhere else.
The Ausfeders Plaza was on its way to becoming a woodland, meaning all the wetland bird species would disappear. What the site needed was open grassland. That's where a biologist named Frans Vira comes in. Frans is widely considered the architect of the Ausfeders Plaza. He first visited the reserve in 1978 and was struck by how a migratory goose species, the Greylag geese, seemed to be keeping the marsh and shallow water bodies open by grazing enormous amounts of reeds every time they stopped by. Here's Frans.
That was, for me, an eye-opener because I saw that the thousands of Greylag geese, it were up to 60,000, they were able, which no manager was able to do, they changed reed beds into shallow open water.
If these geese can steer the landscape toward open marsh, Frans figured, other grazers could probably create the grasslands that would prevent thick forest from taking over. Ecologists generally thought that prehistoric Europe was covered in dense forest. But Frans had the radical idea that Europe was actually a wood pasture, a patchy mosaic of open meadow dotted with stands of trees. And instead of animals following whatever landscape was there, they were actually creating the landscape. Animals like...
the aurochs, which is the wild ancestor of our domestic cows. We had the wild horse, the wild ox, the European bison. We had a whole menagerie of large grazing ungulates.
Could this chapter of history be replicated? Frans got a job at the Dutch Forestry Service, and over the 1980s and 90s, together with allies in other government ministries, he started to bring big ungulates, hoofed mammals, to the Ausfeders Plaza. He chose the closest analogs to prehistoric grazers that he could find. There were 32 hardy Hek cattle, which the Nazis backbred from domesticated cows, to be as close to wild as possible. 18 semi-feral conic horses from Poland, and 52 massive red deer from Scotland. Central to Franz's experiment was non-intervention. He wanted to see what would happen if the grazers were left completely unmanaged. No feeding, medicating, or any other human tinkering. Around the same time, the concept of rewilding had emerged in North America. Rewilding was grander than saving rare species in protected pockets. It was about creating huge, self-sustaining ecosystems with minimal human involvement. Soon, the Osvaldersplatte became a poster child of rewilding. Jamie Lorimer, a rewilding expert at Oxford, says the reserve started to receive EU funding to create
the Serengeti behind the dikes, with a little bit of African wilderness right here in the suburbs of Amsterdam on this island that was reclaimed from the sea.
If all this seems ambitious to you, it maybe isn't to the Dutch. I talked to Clemens Driessen, a Dutch geographer whose research revolves around the idea that nature is deeply cultural. Clemens says, in a country that would largely be underwater if not for dams, dikes, and canals, there's this idea that human ingenuity can birth entire landscapes. There's even a saying,
God created the world, but the Dutch created the Netherlands.
And that narrative was applied to the Osvaldersplatte too, framed as a feat of human engineering.
So not only can the Dutch make agricultural land, we can even make wilderness.
For the most part, things progressed in the Osvaldersplatte through the 90s and 2000s without too much disturbance. It seemed the large grazers were in fact creating grasslands, preventing forest from filling in. There were debates for sure. When animals died during some harsh winters, a committee of experts decided to introduce a strategy of reactive culling, meaning they would shoot animals that likely wouldn't survive the spring. There were some big public successes, too. Like in 2006, when a pair of white-tailed eagles, birds with wingspans the size of a garage door, came to the Osvaldersplatte. They were the first pair to breed in the Netherlands since the Middle Ages. And in 2013, a documentary called The New Wilderness came out, documenting life in the Osvaldersplatte. It was a box office sensation, breaking records for how many visitors it drew to the cinemas. Public morale was high. Yet, throughout this time, those close to the reserve were seeing cracks. All those herbivores were eating everything, much more than expected. The stands of shrubs and trees that Franz Vera hypothesized would appear, they were grazed before they could make it past seedling stage. The decline in vegetation diversity seemed to be leading to a decline in the species and numbers of birds, particularly threatened breeding bird species. Not to mention, there were inconsistencies in the whole non-intervention approach. I spoke with an ecologist named Frank Burens, who was actually Franz Vera's former mentor and an early advocate of the Osvaldersplatte. Frank says non-intervention is romantic in theory. Who doesn't like the idea of giant grazers recreating a world before humans?
I'm also myself really attracted by the idea of real wilderness, real wild nature.
But every step along the way was an intervention. Claiming the land from sea, introducing Heck cattle and Koenig horses, and then when that didn't seem to be enough, red deer. When a wild boar once showed up at the reserve, rangers decided to shoot it.
They follow a so-called non-intervention strategy, but if nature behaves differently from what they really like to see, what they had planned to see, then they make many times the decision still to take another intervention step. Yeah, that's not very consistent.
There were other problems. As far as nature reserves go, the Osvaldersplatte is pretty small, and the large herbivores are fenced in to prevent conflict with neighboring farmers. There was hope that predators, like wolves, might eventually enter the reserve and help keep the large grazers in check. But they haven't. At least not yet. So the number of large herbivores continued to climb, up to more than 5,000. In the winter, when wild animals might naturally migrate to higher ground in search of food, these grazers, all fenced in, had nowhere to go. Which brings us to two winters ago. The winter Karen Soltank first visited the Osvaldersplatte. That winter was particularly harsh, and there just wasn't enough vegetation for all the grazers. More than 3,000 of them, 60% of the horses, cattle, and deer, died. The mass starvation and mortality were visible from the trains that ran past the reserve. Karen was part of a well-organized group of animal rights activists and protesters that stoked public outrage. They spread images of emaciated corpses on Facebook, had teams feeding hay to the grazers 24 hours a day. People called Franz Vera Hitler, sent him death notes, threatened his grandchildren. Right-wing parties joined the protest, partly motivated, conservationists say, by economic interests of wanting to develop a nearby airport or make the Oostvaardersplassen more of a tourist destination. Koen Arts is a Dutch social scientist who studies nature conservation. He says it was a perfect storm of factors that brought the situation to a boil. You had the traditional agrarian slice of Dutch society, farmers, hunters, horse riders, who have established ways of relating to deer and domesticated horses and cows. Then you had an urban public that tended toward anthropomorphic ideas of animal suffering. Combine that with
social media and imagery of dying animals, that somehow goes to the core of human feelings, if you like, and they are bound to raise controversies.
Clemens Driessen, the geographer who studies cultural ideas of nature, said that eventually a deep polarization set in.
A kind of rift emerged between what was conceived as state ecologists being engaged in a secret experiment and populists who were, according to the ecologists, more irrational, emotional animal lovers.
Last September, the province of Flevoland called for a change in the management of the Oostvaardersplassen, with a plan to drastically reduce the number of animals. They set an upper limit of 1,100 for the number of large grazers on the reserve, meaning more than 1,800 deer had to be shot, much of their meat sold for food. Herds of horses have been transported to nature reserves in Spain and Belarus, and this past spring, they fed some ailing cattle in the reserve. It's safe to say non-intervention no longer applies in the Oostvaardersplassen. In the wake of the changes, some have called the reserve a failed experiment in rewilding. For Franz Vera, it's been a painful turn of events. He's been excluded from decision-making about the reserve. He says it's a shame the experiment was cut early. Nature operates on a much longer timescale than a political term, a human career, or a mortal lifespan.
You know how old the area is. It's from 1968. So people, it's like saying to a baby, you have to walk and you have to get a job. The area is still a baby. And now we expect the area to behave as an adult.
Franz maintains that if people had let the reserve continue to run its course, the grazers' population would have stabilized, and that mosaic wood pasture might still have emerged.
You know, there are many people who had ideas which were not accepted as a certain moment, but eventually they proved to be right. I have the feeling I left a good message for nature conservation, and that's what I am in my heart, a nature conservationist.
That story was reported by Steph Yin. Virtual reality technology allows you to enter into different worlds, but you kind of look a little ridiculous, especially when you try it for the first time. We checked out a demo at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Ethan Miller gets everyone set up.
All right, give me a second to get this open and loading for you here. Your two controllers here.
People hold wireless controllers in each hand. There's a headset that looks kind of like ski goggles.
Adjust it till it looks clear and in focus, and then I'll tighten the straps for you.
Then Ethan starts up a program on a laptop.
Okay. Now, do you want to do ghosts or clowns? Those are our two horror games on here.
Inside the headset, an artificial scene fills the user's entire field of vision. They can look around in it, move their arms and legs. From the outside, it looks a bit like they're fighting invisible bees. They jump and duck and startle. There's a lot of panicked flailing. It looks fun. But some VR gamers say this can be so much more than play. They say it can have therapeutic value. Reporter Jad Slayman looked into this.
Keir Simmons is a new dad living near Houston, and for most of his life, he's come off as a bit of a jerk.
Did you ever watch the show Big Bang Theory?
It's a network TV sitcom, number one in America for a while.
So when that show first came out, I had friends calling me up saying, dude, you should watch this show. That Sheldon guy's you.
If you haven't seen it, Sheldon is the main character, a super smart nerd who can be awkward and abrasive.
Jerk. But you don't think I'm condescending, do you?
Well...
Oh, I'm sorry. Condescending...
I know what it means!
Keir works in tech, and like the Sheldon character, he's from Texas.
A lot of it does unfortunately line up. And so I was like, oh, okay, that's fair.
Keir doesn't mean to come off the way he does. He has Asperger syndrome, a disorder on the autism spectrum that makes social interaction really tricky.
The closest description is when I hear a comedian talk about going into like a group and they kill, or going into a group and they like completely bomb, like it's just brutal. And I was like, wow, that actually, most of my life I'm bombing.
When Keir would play video games with people online, things were different, especially in PlanetSide 2, this massive shooter. You can yell out to players near you in the game with a voice chat feature.
And I would just kind of throw on my best Monster Truck Rally impression.
I ask him for a demonstration.
It's your man, Pooh Nanners, your Texas caster and hype master. Rocket see you live from Andor Excavation Site. This rockin' bunch
here
of
is, of course, Pooh Nanners. To his surprise, though, people didn't just laugh. They actually listened.
And people would just flock, and we would just, like locusts, just wash over the land and just destroy. And I'd get people to do all kinds of hilarious stuff.
He could be Pooh Nanners, this monster truck commander online, at ease with people he'd never met. But offline, he was still Sheldon. Then, a new type of gaming platform came out, the Oculus Rift virtual reality headset. And it had this early game called Echo Arena.
In zero gravity, players fly faster.
It's a futuristic sports game, like Ultimate Frisbee in space, all very Tron-looking. Players rocket around trying to get this disc to a goal, bash each other.
And it looked absolutely wild, and it looked beautiful.
Keir had barely started flying around in the virtual world when he took a bad fall in the real world. He was fixing something on his roof and thought,
I'm just going to take a few steps backwards, and then I'll get like a line of sight on it. And I wake up on the ground with EMTs putting a neck brace on me and a broken leg. I fell 25 feet.
He had surgery, got an opioid prescription during recovery, and when that ran out, he went into withdrawal, had his first panic attack, and developed an intense depression and anxiety.
So with depression, right, they told me that I needed to be around people.
They being his therapists. But when dealing with depression, I mean, it can be hard to even go outside. And remember, Keir was never exactly good with people to begin with. But he had his VR kit, all set up with this space ultimate frisbee game. So he decides to go online and join a match.
I'm just sweating to death playing, I'm having a good time, camaraderie with people, what I see people do when they play like basketball together.
He says it felt like real social interaction.
Like I'm having that experience, playing sports with other people and making friends. And it's doing a lot for my mental health and a lot for my well-being.
VR just made everything more convenient, simpler.
In VR, you put the headset on and you're just there. You definitely also don't have to do any of the other things that you get anxiety about and freak out about. You're like, I have to go take a shower, I have to do my hair, I have to put on some clothes, are my clothes even clean? You know, like you don't have to worry about any of that. You just put the headset on and play.
He talks about VR like it's some lifeline he stumbled onto in the depths of his depression and anxiety. And Keir, he's big in the VR gaming scene. He runs a commentary site and told me he's not alone. lots of VR gamers are finding a kind of unexpected relief. I wanted to know how exactly VR works, so I reached out to Jeremy Bailenson, director of the Virtual Human Interaction Lab at Stanford University in California. He tells me about a demo he did for a bunch of legal types back in 2001.
We had a federal judge who was probably in his 60s and a big guy.
The team boots up a simulation that puts a deep chasm in the middle of the room.
We then drop a plank across the chasm where they basically have to walk over this rickety plank to get to the other side.
The honorable whoever starts making his way across the virtual plank, but slips off the side.
His reaction was to dive at a 45-degree angle in the middle of the floor in front of all of these judges and lawyers.
Jeremy actually caught the guy.
Luckily, he didn't get hurt, nobody got sent to jail. He didn't sue us. But this illustrates this concept of presence.
Presence, Jeremy tells me, is when the player is no longer aware of the medium, in this case, a VR rig. All they're left with is the experience. When you're using VR, he says, you're not guiding an avatar across a plank like in a video game. Instead, as far as your brain is concerned, you are walking a plank.
I can tell you a funny joke that I give at talks, and it's not actually funny, but what are the five most important features that make a VR experience effective?
No idea.
Tracking, 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 and tracking.
Tracking. You move your body and the image you see changes. Turn your head, lean this way, lift your arm. The image the headset shows you reflects that in real time.
The brain has got dedicated real estate that is about moving your body. So the sensory motor cortex, there's the word motor in it and obviously the word sensory in it. And this is a part of your brain that has, you know, for as long as people have been people, we've engaged with scenes, physical scenes, by moving our bodies and by getting feedback from that movement.
He says VR, as opposed to traditional media, taps right into this basic part of our wiring to make things feel just real.
It's a simple medium in the sense that you're just doing the same things that you've always done out in nature. You're just getting separate perceptual feedback that you wouldn't have gotten otherwise. So VR uses the natural evolutionary mechanisms that just we've always been used when we've explored scenes.
Jeremy sees VR revolutionizing all these different corners of daily life, from how we think about business meetings to how we take vacations. He even had a hand in a program that trains rookie retail workers for the horrors of Black Friday. But I'm interested in the therapeutic potential, and so is this guy.
Sure. My name is Skip Rizzo. I'm a clinical psychologist and neuropsychologist.
He's director of the Medical Virtual Reality Lab at the University of Southern California. For years, he's used VR to help treat veterans with PTSD. He says, put one such patient in an fMRI and cue up the right audio-visual cues.
We see hyperactivation of the amygdala, the fight-or-flight area in the brain.
Classic example, a vet with PTSD may see some trash on the side of a California highway, but feel a fear that's as real as the fear they felt on an Iraqi highway as an IED disguised as garbage exploded.
They react as if it's the real thing.
For people with chronic PTSD, these triggers come often and linger for years. A common treatment is exposure therapy. A patient describes a troubling event or source of anxiety to a therapist over and over again, imagining it, confronting it in a safe setting until it starts to lose its bite. In VR, you don't have to imagine.
We have 14 different worlds that represent different contexts in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Vets carry a prop gun. There's rigs for vehicles, even a smell device that produces scents of gunpowder and burning trash.
The clinician can ignite explosions around them, IEDs at different distances, intensities, can have jets fly over helicopters.
Skip says using VR has accelerated treatment for his vets when compared to the traditional talk and imagine methods. He says that's critical because many patients will drop out of treatment too early when it doesn't seem to be helping quickly enough. I ask him about VR gamers, these players finding relief. Could this be possible? Short answer, yes.
I like to say that we can get people to confront things in VR that they wouldn't do in the real world, all right? To go into a social situation with a lot of people, to get a person with social phobia to do that or somebody with autism to do that, they're so anxious, they may avoid it, they may use coping strategies that are less effective, And it's not a therapeutic exposure.
But he emphasizes guys like Keir, who feel like they're finding therapeutic value in VR, they've only discovered a tool, not a cure. And VR, it's a tool most useful when handled by a clinician. Still, he says, if VR can help people recognize the potential of getting actual clinical help, it's a good thing.
A large majority of the people with mental health problems never see the inside of a therapy office. You know, they go through life, you know, managing and getting by and so forth. And that's mind-numbing.
VR is making its way into therapy. There's at least one app currently in development that puts patients in a virtual group therapy session overseen remotely by a clinician. As for Keir, aka Poon Anners, he has a real-life therapist he sees in person. VR hasn't made its way into his regular treatment, which, it's important to note, he still relies on. He still struggles and works hard to stay well. But he says leaning on VR helped him stay well enough to do the hard work of therapy, of taking care of himself. And the people around him, they've noticed a change in him.
So what had happened was while I was playing those VR esports games and making friends and getting that extra social interaction that I needed on a constant basis, it was that Christmas when my sisters came to visit.
They visit every year at the holidays. Keir comes from a big family.
That was the time that they had noticed that I had changed.
Pre-VR Keir and post. He says they weren't too specific. He just seemed nicer, easier to talk to. But there was one instance he shared with me.
One of my sisters was having a panic attack, and I had noticed that she had disappeared, so I went to go find her. It was something we had said.
It was over something trivial, but that's just how panic disorders often work. Another one of his sisters, Serena, was trying to help, but
she's talking the way that I've talked most of my life, which is very fast, not a lot of emotion in it, just very, you know, directly talking to you and explaining to you why you're wrong, usually.
Not what someone coming out of a panic attack wants to hear. Keir stepped in.
And that's, I said to her exactly what I just said to you. Serena, you can't hear it, but in your tone of voice and your word choice, it sounds like you're attacking her. I know you're not, but that's how it's being received.
He asked her to leave the room just for a second to calm things down, and it worked.
And all of my three other sisters all just looked at me dumbfounded.
Not bad for a guy who's always being compared to Sheldon Cooper from Big Bang Theory.
Bazinga.
Not bad at all.
Yeah, that's very comforting.
For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about man-made worlds. With VR games, you strap on a headset and enter into a different world. Augmented reality games superimpose a layer of magic and excitement onto the real world around you. A boring bus ride can become a fun treasure hunt with Pokemon Go, or a game called Ingress turns your commute into a tense battle for territory. Ingress was first launched in 2013. It was created by engineers from the Google Earth team. Players have to physically travel to destinations to complete tasks in the game, and it gets very, very competitive. Reporter Nathan Miller played the game in Detroit, a city with a layout that seems to be ideal for true Ingress warriors.
All right, my first Ingress mission.
I'm getting in the car with Mark Moritz Rabson, one of the top Ingress players.
No, I'm sorry. Missions are something different. Missions are a specific thing. This is an operation. Okay.
The Ingress app uses your phone's GPS and looks like a futuristic Google Maps. It guides you to landmarks around the city called portals, which you can then either capture, destroy, or link together to establish territory. While many of the highest scoring players in the world are located around Shanghai, Mumbai, or other dense Asian megacities, Mark lives in Detroit, Michigan, where efficient road design and natural topography have made it an unexpectedly fertile playing ground.
So that's this portal.
So are you killing portals right now?
Yeah, I am, because that's the one I mentioned that was a drive-by, because it's that clock on the corner of Alter and Warren.
Mark so instinctively clicks his phone as we drive that I hardly realize when we've started to play the game. Portals can take the form of parks, murals, churches, or any notable site that's been submitted by users into the game's database.
So, you know, graveyard portals are a big thing because they close. So I know one dude that will, like, pretend to be the gatekeeper. So he'll capture a portal at like 4:30, then he'll like put on a nice ass suit. And when the other Ingress players roll up, who he knows, who don't know him, he'll be like, I'm sorry, like, we're closed early today. It's like...
Players will go to crazy lengths to score points in the game. To capture a portal, Mark recently took a private plane to Peely Island, the southernmost point in Canada, 40 miles southeast of Detroit. If Mark can connect the portal on Peely to portals on opposite sides of Detroit, he'd take control of all the territory in between. And that's what we're doing tonight.
Are we going to the whole other side?
Yeah. Dude, I don't do it unless I'm going to cover the whole city. It's not worthwhile to me to play like small games.
On a map, Detroit is bigger than Boston, San Francisco, and Manhattan combined. But it doesn't have the gridlock that can plague these other cities.
Yeah, I couldn't do this anywhere else in the world.
I spoke to Jeff Horner, senior lecturer in the Department of Urban Studies and Planning at Wayne State University in Detroit.
Detroit is a city that one time had 2 million people in it. Now it's got maybe 700,000. So the roads are not that crowded.
Detroit players also benefit from being in a city that was specifically designed for cars alongside the automotive industry.
Detroit is a city that grew up not before the automobile, but not after it, but with it.
Detroit's wide Baroque thoroughfares crisscross with several interstate highways, and the city's lack of hills or natural barriers means we can travel across its length in minutes.
So do we have to make that?
It just hasn't loaded yet. I'm sorry.
It's just before midnight, and we've reached our destination. Mark clicks a button on his screen to connect the portals we've been capturing.
There we go.
Oh my God.
I watch as the entirety of Detroit and neighboring Windsor, Canada, become blanketed by a yellow triangle, and scores flash on Mark's screen. Mark takes a screenshot of his accomplishment and saves it to a folder with many others. While Mark will often play in the dead of night when his opponents are asleep, Gabe Blonsky is another Detroiter who instead plays every morning along his commute to work.
You know, it gets me going in the morning. I mean, some people go jogging. I wake up, I look at Intel, and it gets me motivated to get out of bed early.
Gabe has been diligently defending the same territory for over 5 years. And part of the reason he loves Ingress so much is his passion for geography.
As a kid, I loved maps. I would sit and look at maps for hours.
Gabe is a lifelong gamer, and some of the time he might have spent playing on his computer at home, he now spends driving and finding new spots to take his family.
There's places that I wouldn't have gone other than to play Ingress, but I found out that once I got there, hey, this is a really cool spot.
For Mark as well, playing Ingress is inherently a process of discovery.
You can't play Ingress at home. You have to get out. You have to go there. You have to, like, interact with the points of interest. You know, you inevitably learn stuff. You can't help it.
The virtual world of Ingress has helped players connect with and immerse themselves in their real environments.
Because it is, like, not so much augmented as just intertwined. It's really inextricable from reality.
That was Nathan Miller reporting from Detroit.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
So far, we've discussed places and worlds that people have created. But let's take this idea to another level. What if each of us live in our own man-made world? Because everything we see is all in our heads. What do I mean by that? Here's an example. A couple of years ago, there was a photograph of a dress that ignited a viral debate.
Finally on this Friday, a seemingly simple question for you. What color is this dress? Take a look. Take a good look. That question has been dividing families and friends all day.
You remember this, right? It seemed like everybody in the entire world had an opinion on whether this dress was white and gold or blue and black.
I and other color neuroscientists had lots of phone calls about this dress. Of course, the nature of the question was, you know, what's happening? Why do we see it this way?
That's Bo Lotto. He is a neuroscientist and the author of Deviate, The Science of Seeing Differently. His work focuses on perception, and he says we often don't see the world around us accurately.
For me, the more powerful element of the story is why it went viral. We're all very familiar with illusions, and this is just another illusion. But why was it so powerful for people? And I think the reason is because while they can accept that two people could have different perceptions of the world in terms of, say, language, a French person versus someone who speaks English, But surely something as basic and fundamental as color, surely there we can see the world the same. But when it was demonstrated that people can actually have different perceptions at that most basic level, it created tremendous doubt in people that they had a real objective view of the world.
So what color was the dress?
Ah, the dress isn't colored.
All right, it's in my head. I forgot.
It's all in your head.
That's true. Okay, so at this point, Bo had already explained to me that color doesn't exist per se, but I wanted to argue a bit more, and I used Bo's book as an example. It has a really bright green cover. If I say this book is green, you will probably agree that the book is indeed green, and we agree that the leaves are green.
Ah, we might agree that the color is the same, but that doesn't necessarily mean the cover of the book is itself green. The cover of the book reflects light. And that light then falls onto our retina, and the brain generates a perception that was based not on the actual reality of the object, because the object is itself not green. It has reflectance, it's physical. But instead, it generates a meaning, and it generates a meaning based on its history. So the green that it sees it because it was useful to see it in the past, not because it's literally objectively green.
So green is not a color, it's a concept in my head.
Yeah, basically.
As I was talking with Bo, it felt like suddenly I was standing on wobbly ground, like things were starting to slip from my grasp. And I was wondering, you know, when we come up with concepts and frameworks, are we explaining the world around us, making it accessible, or are we creating the world around us? It seems to me that one of the earliest things we do as humans is to sort things into like and not like. So a small child can look at a rubber duck and a duck on a pond and a drawing of a duck and call it a duck. Same with a dog. So we see concepts and we sort them. And we have to do that in order to learn anything, right? So we're not questioning every time, can I put this glass on the table or is it going to fall right through the table?
That's sort of the very basic question, the essential question, which is, if everything I'm doing is grounded in my history, including the categorizations that you came up with the duck, ask it a different way, what does experience give us? What it gives us are our assumptions and our biases. So everything you're seeing and doing is in fact a reflex, in the same way that your leg jumps out when you hit your patellar tendon. It's a reflex. Your perceptions are a reflex. And they're grounded in your history of experience, which gives you assumptions. And those assumptions are phenomenally useful. They keep us alive. Every time you take a step, your brain has hundreds of assumptions about the world, about its body. But if that's true, how could we ever see differently? And the first step to seeing differently is to have awareness that we're actually constructing these perceptions based on our history and that everything we're doing is a bias.
Do you do this all day long with everything, or do you try to
That would be a nightmare.
Yes. Bo says it doesn't make sense to challenge everything all of the time. But if you want to see outside of the world you've created in your head, it's important to remind yourself of your own perceptions and biases. Can we ever really come to an agreement in terms of an experience or something perhaps two people witnessed? Or it seems just like we would never stand on firm ground with anything or with very few things.
So yes, we can have an agreement because we're both also making a prediction about what's going to happen next. And we can have a similar prediction. So now we seem to have an agreement, right? That's one aspect. The other question is, can you actually see another person? Know another person, right? Mm-hmm. And actually, we have literally no access to what's inside their head. And we never have access to what's inside their head. People are just the sources of meaningless data. In fact, the words that I'm using right now are themselves meaningless in themselves. But then we construct a meaning based on our history. So every personality that you have of another person is actually inside you projected outward. So in the same way we color the world, we actually color other people. And we color other people based on our history of experience of what they're doing meant in the past. right? So we project a meaning onto people, but the meaning actually exists within us.
Thinking about all of this, I feel confused. It feels kind of exciting, but it also feels terribly confusing. What is the benefit of thinking this way and really questioning so many things that we take for granted? And on some level, I feel like we have to take for granted just to get through our day.
There are lots of things we have to take for granted. But what's the benefit of this? The benefit of this is openness, right? The possibility of actually taking ownership in your own perceptions and also the freedom to do so, right? So, in fact, the way I start off the book is just tell the reader that I want them to know less at the end of the book than they think they know now. Because nothing interesting begins with knowing. It begins with not knowing. Nothing interesting begins with an answer. It begins with a question. And that's the basis of science. In fact, that's the basis of anything that is creative, is you enter the situation with a question. In fact, think about it in terms of conflict resolution. Think what would happen if people entered conflict with doubt, with not knowing instead of knowing. Imagine they entered conflict with a question instead of an answer. Only in that way can you actually learn in conflict rather than just be in conflict, right? Rather than winning. So the question is, do you win or do you learn? So if I can demonstrate that this is true at the most fundamental level of how we actually make perceptions of red, then it has to be true all the way up. So I'm trying to encourage and celebrate the concept of doubt, but doubt with courage, because you still have to step forward.
Give me some homework. What can I do to wrap my brain around this or to question some assumptions on an everyday basis?
Well, the first step is just to accept that everything you do has a bias. Not sometimes, but all the time. And one piece of homework would be the next time you're in a conflict, rather than approach that conflict with fear or anger, you approach it in a different way with a question and try to find out why the person is saying what they do, not just what they're saying. Because you might find there's actually much more common ground between you if you could approach it from the perspective of the why, rather than disagreeing over the who, what, where, and when.
Bo Lotto is a neuroscientist and director of the Lab of Misfits. It's an experiential research lab in New York City. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yube, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.